Hello, and welcome to Such a Nightmare, Conversations about Horror. My name is Dr. Catherine Troyer, and joining me is Anthony Tresca.
Hello there.
In this podcast, we discuss that fine line between the horrific and the horrible. Each episode looks at a specific horror text that is, for better or worse, giving us nightmares. We are excited and thankful to have you join us for our inaugural episode focused on the 2017 film It Chapter 1. I have a lot of conversations about horror, probably like on a daily basis.
Well, I might imagine that comes with having a PhD in horror.
Yeah, I mean, that I think helps.
Yeah.
It could also be the fact that I have a life-size Pennywise in my office.
Oh, is that what that was?
Yeah, just the thing lurking. In fact, even today it scared me. The lights turned on and I turned around and he was standing behind me. So, like, that he's noticeable.
I mean, I'll admit the 6-foot cardboard cutout of Pennywise the clown is a conversation starter.
Yes, it is. I would have to say that some of my favorite conversations about horror are actually with you.
Aww.
I know. It's very sweet. And it's because, in large part, that this is the only time I feel like we're ever in agreement when it comes to film.
Yeah, that's probably true, because it seems like with most other genre of films, we agree less.
Yeah, like, to show you, dear listeners, how bad it is, if there's a film and I'm like, ugh, please don't make me watch that, my second thought is almost always, Anthony's gonna adore it.
And most of the time, I do.
He recommends films, and I promise I put them on my, like, I'll watch these someday list, but they are hundreds and hundreds down. So it's nice and it's refreshing to have these conversations about horror, because we are often very much in alignment, and even when we're disagreeing, we're oftentimes agreeing in our disagreement.
Exactly. And it's so weird, because it's also even the exact problems we have. Down to that, we can diagnose a problem the exact same way.
And it's the things we like, too, that we're like, you know what I really liked? And then you'll finish the sentence, and I'll be like, yes, that was exactly what
we were having a conversation right before we started recording this podcast about the film we're going to talk about today, and we just were finishing each other's sentences with things we liked and things we didn't like about the film.
And sometimes the things that we are in agreement with, it's what other people think, but a lot of times it seems like we're in agreement with each other, but we're really in the minority.
Yeah, this comes with our larger group of peers, but also sometimes with critics or other scholars.
Mm-hmm.
We don't necessarily always share their same opinion, but we are in agreement.
And so in this podcast, a lot of the films that we're going to look at are either ones that were really well received by the general public or really, really well received by the general, like, critical reception, but that for some reason we really had a problem with you and I.
Yeah, they just don't work for us personally.
And it's kind of alienating to be like, everyone loves this film, but I hate it so much, or I really don't like it. And so that, I think, is nice to have that sort of dissenting voice.
And the other type of film that we like to talk about are films that it seems like nobody liked. And we are in that small little minority again, being like, no, but this film is actually really cool.
Yeah, sometimes they're sleeper hits, so they're ones that, like, kind of have a little bit of a cult following, but a lot of times they just kind of fall by the wayside amongst all the other horror that's been coming out. We are going to make what may seem like a bit of a exception with today's episode. Today we're going to be talking about the 2017 film It.
It was received fairly well by all standards. I mean, on Rotten Tomatoes, it is certified fresh. It has an 86% from the critics. Its Metacritic score is a 69%. User score on Rotten Tomatoes is an 84%, and user score on Metacritic is a 7.8.
And so really, the only one that's not, like, a really good, quote, passing grade is that 69 meta score. But even that is, for a horror film, is not bad.
No, not bad at all. So overall, it does seem like the critics are pretty much in agreement. They liked it.
Anthony and I also really like this film, right?
This was one of the first films that I really, really liked in the horror genre.
And I just, it delighted me, right? Like, it's one of those films that I'm watching and I'm like, and this is why I like the genre. But but we wanted to do this episode on it because it seems like people are either sort of taking it either wholesale as this is the best film ever, or just like, well, it's got problems, therefore it's a film that we should ignore, rather than seeing it as, you know, it can be flawed and still be a great film.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into discussing the film proper, we like to do a little bit of academic framework to kind of set it up. But don't fear, listeners, this is not scary academia jargon, and there will be no quizzes.
Yeah, that's good to know.
So you can rest easy, and we're going to try to make this as fun and as simple as possible.
Yeah, and honestly, some of it's because I feel like I should have to use my PhD muscles.
Yeah, I mean, if you worked and paid as much money for that PhD, I mean, you should use it.
Yeah, the student loans are worth this moment, right? But I also think it's important because I don't want us to think of the horror genre ever as just this sort of popular dribble, which, of course, is what a lot of people mm-hmm. think of it as. Like, how could you possibly devote your life to studying it or writing it unless there's something fundamentally wrong with you? Mm-hmm. But when you look at the scholarship, well, you realize... Well,
people may be right about that part of it.
Aw, that's sad. That makes me so sad in my heart. I'm going to say no. You can be normal and still devote your life to it.
Yeah, okay, fine.
But you're right, right? Like, so it is something that is unique. It is something that mm-hmm. is haunting. It's something that's disturbing. And I think that using this academic framework becomes a really powerful way to understand, why am I terrified? Why is the horror genre constantly coming back? Why are we having this rebirth of the horror genre in a sort of profound way in the last few years? And I think turning to the scholars is an excellent way to do so.
So which scholars are we going to be using as our framework today?
So today, we're actually not going to use any official horror scholar.
What?
I know. Today, we're actually going to use a framework given to us in literary criticism. And that's this idea of the Bildungsroman, which is a German word that breaks down to this idea of the novel of formation. A non-German way to think of it would be...
thank goodness.
Would be to think of the coming-of-age narrative.
I do know that one, yes.
And of course, coming-of-age narratives have also had a sort of... rebirth in the young adult genre, right? Where we have this whole genre that has sprung up to be exclusively and sort of solely about what does it mean to be coming of age in this dystopic time mm-hmm. or this modern era.
Yeah, and I think something is very interesting about this coming of age, young adult novels and films is that a lot of them are kind of dystopic and horrific.
And I think there's good reason for that, because if you remember back, it kind of was not a great time, right? Like, there's so many... We talk about growing pains, right? We actually use the word pain to describe this coming-of-age process.
Not always easy.
It's certainly not. So I want to actually go to the person who really sort of helped us to understand this idea of the Bildungsroman, or the coming-of-age narrative. And his name is Jerome Hamilton Buckley. And in 1974, he produced this text, which was called Season of Youth, The Bildungsroman from Dickens to Golding. And so he was looking at, like, classic literature. But it works so perfectly for what we're going to talk about today, because he said that these texts needed to have as many as possible of the following characteristics or themes. They needed to be about childhood, the conflict of generations, the larger society, self-education, alienation, ordeal by love, a search for a philosophy, for a vocation or work or just life. Mm-hmm. And this is what it is about at its core.
Yeah.
Independent of the giant dancing clown. This is which I realize is a big part of it.
It's a big thing to separate from the film.
But independent of that, this is a film that you and I were talking about, like, the most disturbing things are the mm-hmm. sort of domestic horrors.
Yeah, it's not all... a lot of the supernatural stuff. It's the stuff that's far more grounded in the town of Derry and the creepy atmosphere that hangs over it.
Yes, and it's about, you know, what do you do when you have feelings for someone but they may or may not have feelings for you? Mm-hmm. What do you do when you're realizing that your body is changing in ways that you're not entirely comfortable with?
Oh, yeah. These are very scary, universal fears.
Yes, and... It, both Stephen King's 1986 novel mm-hmm. and the miniseries from 1990, but especially this 2017 film, really embraces this idea that there's something simultaneously magical and horrifying about this moment of transition in our mm-hmm. lives.
So a little bit about it, and I will be making that pun many, mm-hmm. Many times throughout this episode.
You should all be glad that you can't see him, like... when he pauses and he's like waiting for the chuckle. So just know he's waiting for the chuckle.
I'm waiting for you, the listener, to chuckle. And if you don't, I will be sad. So a little bit about it. We'll try it again. It is a 2017 American supernatural horror film based off, as you mentioned, the 1986 Stephen King novel. It's directed by Andy Muschietti and written by Chase Palmer, Cary Fukunaga, and Gary Daberman. It is second adaptation of the novel, following, also as you mentioned, the 1990 miniseries, and a sequel is planned to this film. So, this film has been in an ongoing sort of development since 2009, which is quite a bit of time. It kind of went through a development hell. To date, the film adaptation has gone through two major phases of planning, initially with Fukunaga, attached from 2009 to 2015, contributions coming from screenwriter David Koganich, and finally with Muschietti coming on in some capacity to contribute to the screenplay.
That really is a kind of nightmare of people.
Yeah, it's a horror in and of itself, the development of this film.
And I can understand why, right? I mean, we're talking about needing to adapt a novel that is 1,100 pages. It's long.
It is dense. Yes. And so Koganich actually spoke to, when he began writing the film, he knew how hard it was going to be, because at that time, the studio who was attached, which was Warner Brothers, wanted it to be just one film.
Oh my gosh.
Actually. And so he wrote a 120-page treatment of the script that combined the multiple characters and the two different time periods that are featured in the book. And at this time, they also knew right from the start that they wanted it to be R-rated, which was good, because this led him to believe that it allowed it to really honor the book and engage with the traumas that these characters endure.
And that's really an important deviation from the 1990 miniseries, right, mm-hmm. which is ABC,
yes.
and has very strict rules about the fact that you can't actually show children in harm. And so there's a lot of, like, cut to.
Exactly. And so that's actually something that the screenwriter at that time actually talked about. He said that the Pennywise in this adaptation is a less self-conscious of his own irony and surreality than was Tim Curry's Pennywise. I think it will be harder to laugh at his antics, since under the permissiveness of an R rating, I was able to give him back a lot of his more upsetting moments from the novel, one that could never be aired on network television. And so that's something that screenwriter actually knew was going to be a benefit to this film.
And thinking on the film, it's one that I think we see in evidence that this is a film that succeeds because it can go places visually and thematically that we need it to go in order to be terrified.
Mm-hmm. Back to the development hell.
Yes.
In 2012, Vanity Fair reported that Cary Fukunaga was boarding the project as a director and would co-write the script with Chase Palmer. But then, in 2014, Warner Brothers passed the project on to New Line Cinema, and it was at this point that the producer, Dan Lin, announced that the project was going to be divided into two films. And he specifically mentions that the first film would be a coming-of-age story about the children tormented by it, and the second would skip ahead in time as those same characters band together to continue the fight as adults. Then, on May 25th, 2015, it was reported that Fukunaga had dropped out as the director of IT. According to The Wrap, he had clashed with the studio and didn't want to compromise his artistic vision in the wake of budget cuts by New Line. However, he maintains in an interview with Variety that he was trying to make an unconventional horror film. It didn't fit into the algorithm of what they knew they could spend and make money back on based on not offending their standard genre audience.
I mean, you have to respect someone for feeling that mm-hmm. they are in disagreement. We have seen examples of horror filmmakers who products ultimately suffer because they say, fine, I'll do the film you want me to do.
Yeah. So, July 16th, 2015, Andrew Muschietti, who directed the 2013 horror film Mama, was announced that he was going to direct it, with New Line beginning a search for another writer to tailor a script to Muschietti's version. So he talks about how his version is different, stating that My version of It highly emphasizes Pennywise's most terrifying virtue, which is its ability to materialize into your own worst fear. I want to take people on a journey into Pennywise's world through a disturbing, surrealist, and intoxicating experience that will leave nobody at ease. The film opened on September 7th, 2017, and it was a box office and critical success. We've already mentioned the critical success earlier, but it broke many box office records and grossed over $700 million worldwide.
That's amazing.
Yeah, unadjusted for inflation, it's the highest grossing R-rated horror film of all time, the highest grossing horror film internationally, and the highest grossing horror film of all time.
Yeah, that's really impressive.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's a great place to begin our discussion. Whenever we begin with a film that we really like, or even when we begin with a film that we have a problem with, we try to keep it very balanced, our discussion.
Yes, we wouldn't want this to devolve into nonsensical yelling or raving.
Right. Yeah, we don't want to either do the equivalent of fangirling or trolling, right? We want to be critical in our sort of thoughts about the film, and critical not as in like judgmental, but just sort of thinking about it carefully. So I think before we get into what are going to be a lot of our compliments about this film and why this film is a great example of what makes the horror genre really powerful, I think that it's worth discussing some of the places where the film doesn't quite work.
There are several. I think that this film is just a touch too long. There's a little bit of things that could be taken out. Particularly, I think that the sequence and when they talk about it wants to divide us is cheesy, and the child actors show their age. And that breakup part is, it's the most unnecessary and I think probably one of the weakest parts of the film.
I don't know if that particular moment bothered me. I don't know at all if I would say the film was too long, but I understand where you're coming from. I think part of the problem is so there's this term in an article by Ashley J. Carranza, where she talks about this idea of the collective child protagonist, or the CCP. And this is what we get in Stranger Things as well, right? Where in many ways, we don't have a single character. It's the collective that
matters. There's no lead. It's groupthink.
Yes, exactly. And so I guess because of that, because I realized that we have a collective child protagonist, I was okay with this moment because it's kind of like the unease in the group, and the group is what matters. But I do see your point that there are moments where it kind of languidly goes through its paces.
And I think that the montage there is just kind of like, that's a little cheesy. It's not the best that this film can do. We know it can do better, and it does do better.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that this is one of those moments where we kind of have that, like, growing pains of it knows that it is a horror film, but it is also trying to be a coming of age narrative
story. Yeah.
And we need that in a coming of age.
That's a minutia problem. I think there are actually things that are far more problematic that exist in this film.
One of my big problems is with Beverly. I think, first off, the actress is phenomenal.
She does a great job.
I often have problems with child stars, and just child characters, period. But almost across the board, I felt like the children cast in this film were top-notch sort of throughout the way. So I don't have a problem with most of Beverly. What I actually have a problem with is something that had nothing to do with the performance and everything to do with the script. And that is that I felt it was unnecessary at the end of the day, it turning into this, like, but the young brave boys must rescue the princess who's been captured and is, you know, like, literally suspended in air, unable to fight back. Now, she does get the last blow, right?
On when they're beating up the clown with the power of friendship.
Yes. That's lovely. But still, you can't do that in 2017.
No. No, you absolutely can't. It's all the worst parts of, like, the Smurfette principle, which, for people who don't know, the Smurfette principle comes from the Smurfs, in which there are so many male Smurfs, but there is a single female, and it is Smurfette. And the only reason that she exists is to be the woman.
Yes.
And that's not always necessarily inherently a bad thing, but it can be problematic.
And it's not ideal in King's 1986 book, And there are things that happen in the book, if you've read the book, which you should, because it's great, but it's also 1,100 pages, so I understand.
It's a long read. You're in for the long haul.
And so there are things that happen that we'll talk about when we have our next episode, which is going to be on It, Chapter 2. Some things that happen that I'm glad that they removed.
Yes. Right?
But in 2017, you just can't have this passive moment in a girl that is otherwise so very powerful.
Because I think that's what I think you've hit the nail on the head about why it's so frustrating. Because the second she gets kidnapped is after she's just had this real empowering moment where she takes back control of her and ownership of her life.
Yes.
After she hits her father on the head. But then she's immediately whisked away and reduced to a floating person who has no agency. And then they do the weird Sleeping Beauty thing. Yes. Where Ben awakes her with a kiss. And
yeah, it's just...
It doesn't read well.
It doesn't read well. And it doesn't read well because this film is, I think, capable of doing better.
And it shows us that it is. Yes. It is capable of doing better.
I also am in agreement with some of the critics that the film, I think... sometimes, again, sort of forgets that it is as good as it is, and it relies on sort of cheap horror tricks to try to get you to be scared instead of remembering, wait a minute, I've already shown you what's really scary. It's some of these domestic moments. Mm-hmm. It's some of the things, like, I find the woman in the painting terrifying.
Very, very creepy.
And she's creepy in part because she's so uncanny. She's familiar looking, but unfamiliar. So in that case, the CGI works perfectly. Mm-hmm. But there are other times, like, when the hair is wrapping around Beverly, that it was like, this just feels cheesy. The blood gushing was horrifying.
Good. Very but good. The reminiscent of Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes. Yeah, kind of this lovely, like, nostalgic moment in a film that's filled with nostalgia.
Nostalgia, yeah.
But I just felt that there were times that it said, you know, well, I guess I'll give the people what they want. And assuming that what the people want is...
was cheesy, loud jump scares with excessive CGI.
Yes.
Which is, again, this film is better than that. Because it does have genuine moments of horror that are created from its domestic setting and the atmospheric nature of Derry as a town. And you can see the effect that this supernatural presence has over not only murdering people and what that does, but just the presence that is over all of the adults in this town that makes them complacent in a lot of things.
And I actually could have seen that played up a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I think that the novel makes the town feel so much more sort of corrupt in its soul than I think is possible to communicate visually.
Interesting.
In the film.
I think it does a pretty good job of doing it because it uses very grotesque facial features and makeup on all of the adult characters. And any time you see the adult characters, they are just either ignoring the protagonist or just downplaying everything they're doing. I think one of the scariest things in this movie is that element. Like, when you see Ben being beat up and the car drives by.
Yes.
And then they see him, but they keep going. And then you see that balloon come up in the back.
That, I think, is a fantastic sequence.
It's really well done because you're like, even in this really domestic moment, this supernatural presence is still there.
Maybe it's some of the other moments that I wanted a little bit more of. So I think about that opening sequence with Georgie. Mm-hmm. And then woman who, like, turns away and then turns back and he's gone. I think I wanted her to perhaps just be like, eh, and go inside. Instead, she kind of gets this, like, semi-worried look on her face. And I realize that we're supposed to understand that the whole town's not, like, evil. It's just broken. I wanted a little bit more of that because that opening sequence... the first about, it's almost 10 minutes, it's about 9.5 minutes, is so gothic in its atmosphere. We have the rain coming down, we have this beautiful music playing.
Yeah, piano.
We have this, like, we see this close-up of Bill ripping this yellowed-ish looking paper. Like, it just feels very perfectly dated, right? Like, it feels out of place.
And it's got really, I think that comes a lot from the use of diegetic sounds.
Yes.
Throughout this, because there's nothing superposed on top of it from any of it. It's all sounds that the characters can actually feel, like what you're talking about, the piano, page tearing, window rubbing, walkie-talkie, light switch, rain, thunder, those little things yes. that just add up to creating a real environment.
Yes, and the sound mixing is so effective because, you know, a light switch is not that loud unless you're a little kid down in the cellar, right? Mm-hmm. And then, and so, like, it just does such a good job in those opening minutes of setting up the atmosphere that I'm not sure it was always able, except for some minor exceptions, like the moment where Ben is being attacked. I'm not sure it's always able to sustain that.
Yeah, I can give it that. It's not as laser-focused on that as it could have perhaps been.
But again, if you think about it, these are really rather minor concerns that we have, mm-hmm. because this is a good example of horror.
And I mean, our complaints were so minor that even mixed in, you already heard some really good things about the film. We just couldn't keep them inside of us anymore.
No, because this is a film that knows how to create that sense of unease, right? Like, that goes beyond just the, like, jump scares come and go. And I love a good jump scare. Like, one of my favorite things to do is to scare people and to be scared by people. Like, I love jump scares.
You know this about me. I'm less high on a jump scare.
I love them. But we can't have them at the expense of other things. And mm-hmm. this is a film that says, okay, we'll throw some of that in. But let's talk about what is scary. Bullies. What is scary? Having parents that are either too involved or not involved mm-hmm. enough. What is scary? To have a fear about something, or to know that something is wrong and to know that no one is willing to believe you because you don't have the power or the prestige to be believed. Mm-hmm. That's what this film is about, and it does it so very well.
So I know you mentioned earlier that you didn't like the hair coming out at Bev in the bathroom scene. Mm-hmm.
It felt very, well, it was CGI'd, right? And it just kind of felt a little like, we get it, hair's gross.
But I will say that I think that the rest of the scene is extremely well done.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It just really plays into that the scariest part of things is the domestic type of things yes. that happen to everyone, and this development of body and menstruation that is happening.
Yeah, so you wouldn't know, but
it's not
a fantastic time, right?
Really?
Like, yeah. Huh. It's like horrifying, in
fact.
I
would have guessed.
Yeah, I know, right? It's just like, it is something that it's surprising that this is something King comes back to, right? This is not uh-huh. the only, Carrie very much plays on this.
The whole opening of Carrie yes, in the shower.
Yes. And you would think that King knew firsthand because mm-hmm. he doesn't do it as a sort of like, ew, isn't it gross how women bleed? Mm-hmm. It's more like, oh, wouldn't it be horrible if this happened to you? And I think it does such a good job, especially in the film. One of my favorite parts is how good of a performance in that moment the actor who plays the father has, because he has to play it as though he doesn't see blood everywhere.
Yeah.
And that is, like, fundamentally disturbing.
He doesn't believe her, and he can't understand what she is going through.
Yes.
And the horror and pain that this young girl is seeing and is experiencing, he can't relate.
And I'm kind of a sucker for the well-done blood in a film splashing on the camera lens. Mm-hmm. And because I think that, like, it's just kind of that nice reminder that it's everywhere. And the film does this. The film does a really good job of making this into something that is, like, imagine if an entire room was just covered in blood, how traumatic that would be. Imagine
pretty icky.
The one person that's supposed to be your protector, who is most certainly mm-hmm. not.
Mm-hmm. He's a lot of things, yeah. but he's not a protector.
No. And he is being in this predator in this space, but he's also not seeing the threat because he is the threat. Mm-hmm. And I think it is. It's a beautiful scene. And then when we have the boys come in and they see it and they help her clean, like, it just, I think, is a very well done sequence in this mm-hmm. film, and one that deserves some high praise for the people in charge of props and set.
And then also her performance.
Yes, absolutely.
She really sells it.
Absolutely. And she's, you know, traumatized and she's shivering, but she's not over the top.
No.
And there are lots of moments like this that I think work in that they're so subtle. And and what I like about them is that, you know, the filmmakers knew exactly what they were doing. They are so careful in creating perfect moments of lighting, perfect moments of sound design, perfect moments of performance. Bill Skarsgård, we haven't even talked about him.
Yeah, it feels like feels weird that we haven't talked about him, but he does a very good job.
He does a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. And I think about that moment when we first are introduced to Pennywise, you know, and Bill Skarsgård is doing a performance where he's, like, drooling, right, mm-hmm. and he's...
And his eyes are going everywhere. Those are his real eyes.
Yeah, not he's CGI. Fantastically capable of doing things, right? And his mouth is contorted. But what I also like about it is that we have some nice things happening with lighting, right? You shouldn't, in theory, on a rainy day, be able to see as well into a sewer as Georgie does.
Well, how many sewers have you looked into on a rainy day?
I feel like a lot because I've been trained to, like, look and make sure that there's nothing in them.
Is there a clown in there? Okay,
yeah, good. Yeah, between, like, it and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I've been taught to be very aware of sewers, I feel like. but there's this great example where he's, like, backlit and frontlit, and it's great. And this is what makes the film so smart, is that it knows how to do things subtly for ultimate effect.
I think one place in which it does take something very subtle and carry it throughout the entire film is a metaphor that ties not only into the larger coming-of-age type of framework that this film operates under and that we've been discussing throughout, but also it's very clever. It's this metaphor that is established extremely early on with the lamb, and it's with Mike's guardian who says to him, you're either out here or you're in there, referring to the lamb, and if you don't make the decision sooner, someone else will make that decision for you. And then you see the gate opening up and a lamb running through, and then it immediately switches to a school when you hear a bell and a door opening up and the children walk out, showing that at the start of this film, they are the lambs.
Exactly. And not only are they the lambs, but the system is what's keeping them penned up.
Right.
It's the system that is the schooling system, but also dairy.
And they don't know it. So they don't get to make the choice. They're exactly like the lamb in the sense that they have no agency or ability to really get out of it, seemingly. But then, by the end of the film, when you see Mike have the, what are those things called? The sheep murder guns.
Yeah. Well, we can go with that.
Okay, so Mike has the sheep murder gun. The metaphor is coming full circle because at the beginning, they were shown to be the lambs, but by the end, now they're the ones pulling the trigger.
And I think you're so right to see this as an important metaphor because they could have chosen any animal, right? But the fact they chose this lamb, the sheep, like this is something that we've been taught is oftentimes going to be representative.
The sacrificial lamb.
Exactly. And so we worry, are these kids going to be the sacrificial lamb to it, to dairy, to the things that are horrible in their lives? And to sort of continue to play with that metaphor, we also have the image of the sewer system as the hamster, like, tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, we kind of think of, like, a hamster circling in its wheel. It's always in its cage. But by the end, they've emerged out, right? Yep. They're outside of the gate that has confined them.
Mm-hmm. And so it's really a full circle moment in which you can actually see through these metaphors and as well as other things that happen in the film, but real development for these characters. And they've gone through a life-changing experience.
Only a summer has passed, but they're now adults, right? They may mm-hmm. still only be 13 or 14, but they're now adults. They are no longer the sheep. And it'll, I think, go interesting ways because I think they're going to kind of revert back for part two if it does anything like what the novel does.
Like the book does. They have to.
Yes. In order to go back out. So this is one of the few episodes where we're going to make it clear, like, when we filmed this episode mm-hmm. in that we have not yet seen, because it has not yet come out, it chapter two.
That will come out on September 6th, 2019.
And so we wanted to do this episode because we wanted to, like, remember how great it part one was mm-hmm. before going to part two.
And also, if any of you haven't seen it in a while and just wanted a quick, fun refresher, give you that little edge on everybody else. So you can seem really smart when you talk about this film.
Yes, you can be like, remember the sheep metaphor?
And you can, all of your friends will be like, what? And then you can really, like, pretentiously explain to people. And then everyone will be like, wow, you watch movies.
Yeah, and you'll be like, yes, I do.
Yes, I do, but in a smart way.
That's right. So we hope that you are as excited about It Chapter 2 as we are. Mm-hmm. I would like to say my last criticism about the film is that I think it missed the mark in setting us up for Episode 2. Mm. So at the very end of the credits, we hear Pennywise's creepy chuckle, and then the film ends.
Yeah, and the title comes up, It. And then you see chapter one.
Yes. And so you know a second chapter is coming. And you really knew, right? Like, you knew that the film could not end, the story could not end with this beautiful moment between Beverly and Bill. You knew it was going to have to go dark again. Mm-hmm. But I really thought that would have been a perfect time for us to hear a voiceover in which someone, you know, like, picks it. We hear a ringing of a phone. We hear it answered. And then a voice says, "Remember our promise? It's back."
Could have been like an end credit scene, like, yes, real Marvel style.
Yeah, and we wouldn't have even needed to see the actors, because, you know, I realize that, like, you don't want to pay an actor for a film that they haven't been a part of yet.
Yeah, and a lot of them at this time hadn't been cast yet.
But any voiceover would have done, like, any male adult would have been sufficient, because I don't think anyone's going to be like, huh, that doesn't sound right. Like, I mean, it could have been anyone. And I think that that's what we have to remember. It is coming back. And we are going to be horrified all over again. So Anthony and I are going to watch It Part 2, as Chapter 2, as soon as it comes out. And we're going to quickly...
Probably that day, actually.
Oh, yeah. No, it's for sure that day.
That day.
Yes. And then we are going to hop on to our microphone and record our second podcast episode, looking at and exploring all of what will hopefully be the wonderful things mm-hmm. coming forth in It Chapter 2.
So, in the meantime...
You can find all of our information in our podcast channel description.
Be sure to give us a like. Share us with your friends. I mean, really, just go talk us up.
Yeah, feel free.
Yeah, any publicity is good publicity. We'll take it from you. So thank you for listening, and be sure to join us next time.